I'm going to call just a little bit of an audible today and save some of the rest of my comments about the Quran itself for this afternoon. And I want to jump over to the Muslim concept of the Trinity and talk a little bit about how they perceive Jesus Christ. And to begin, let's take a moment just to take in this very beautiful sight. Some of you have been here before. Anybody know what that gold domed structure is? Anybody? It's in Jerusalem, right? It's the Dome of the Rock. Yeah, it's the Dome of the Rock. This is the second most sacred site in Islam. And when it was completed around 691, 692 AD, there were two inscriptions that can be found on the walls inside. The first says, "Praise be to God who begets no son and has no partner." And the other, "He is God, one, eternal. He does not beget, he is not begotten, and he has no peer." Now in those two statements, we find a summation of the Muslim perspective of Jesus Christ. They do not consider him to be the Son of God in the sense that he is of divine origin. They see him as a created being, as a man that was formed, albeit a little bit unconventionally, but formed still like Adam. God said, "Be," and he was. So they believe that Jesus Christ is a created being, that he is not divine or deity in origin. Now in Islam, there is a doctrine called Tawhid, and this is a central doctrine to the Muslim faith. And basically, this doctrine expresses the oneness of Allah. We saw that doctrine expressed in those two quotations earlier. The best example that I can give of what Tawhid entails comes from the Shahada, which is the Muslim confession of faith, which when one becomes a Muslim, this must be stated in Arabic. "There is only one God worthy of worship, and Muhammad, his prophet." That idea of one God or oneness of God, that is the idea of Tawhid. That he has no partner, no equal. There is no other beside him. The Muslims hold what is called a Unitarian view of God. It's a view of God that we find in some Christian denominations as well, although it's not all that prevalent here in the United States. It is over more so in Europe. The Unitarian view of God basically rejects the divinity of Jesus. A Unitarian view of God accepts his moral authority, but not his divine origin. The Unitarian Church of England is a good example of a so-called Christian denomination that is Unitarian in its worldview, although I would dispute the fact that that could possibly be Christian, because a Unitarian view is foreign to the Bible. Muslims are very strict Unitarians, and the one who will not accept there is one God is guilty of what they call shirk. This basically boils down to associating anyone or anything with the one true God. And it is, in Islam, the one unforgivable sin. Anyone who is guilty of shirk has no hope of being in paradise. No hope whatsoever. I think the verse that we can point to in the Quran that succinctly summarizes this perspective and how big an offense shirk is Surah 4:48. "Surely Allah will not forgive those who assign partners to Him. He forgives all but that to whom He pleases. Whosoever ascribes partners to Allah is guilty of a monstrous sin." This is the idea of shirk. But this doesn't really give the full sense of what Muslims are taught. I mean, this verse, I think you can see how you might get the idea of shirk from this, but that really doesn't encapsulate what Muslims are taught in the madrasas and the mosques. Believers are taught from the hadiths, and we talked about the hadiths last night. These are extra-Quranic writings that purport to be the sayings and acts of Muhammad that were passed down by oral tradition and were written down in the 9th century AD. From the hadith, Muslims are taught that believers are told not to pray for those who are guilty of shirk. In other words, if you've got a person who is guilty of worshiping multiple gods, don't even pray for them. There's no point. They're irretrievably lost. In fact, so severe is this point of view that Muhammad was forbidden by Allah to pray for his mother who died a pagan, died guilty of shirk. That's how severe this penalty is considered. Sheikh Yasir Qadi sums up shirk in this way. Shirk involves believing in a partner along with Allah. Such a partner could be a partner in lordship, or in worship, or in attributes. In other words, the essence of shirk involves giving Allah's rights to other than He. Therefore, to claim that a certain object or deity has the power to bless one with one's needs is shirk. Likewise, to prostrate or make dua to other than Allah is also shirk. And the claim that any created object knows everything or can hear any plea to it is shirk. Whenever any specific right of Allah's is given to any other object, whether that object be a living being or an inanimate object, real or imagined, shirk has occurred. Can you see? I mean, it couldn't be any plainer. Any sort of divine attributes, any sort of worship, any sort of consideration that is given to anything or anyone other than Allah, that person is guilty of shirk. In Surah 41, verse 6, Allah tells Muhammad, "O Prophet, say to them, I am only a human being like you. It is revealed to me that your God is only one God, so be upright before Him and ask Him to forgive you. And woe to those who associate others with Him." Once again, we have this very Unitarian view of God. And notice, Muhammad goes to great pains to make it plain that he is a created being. He's a human being. He's not an equivalent of Jesus Christ as the Christians understand Him. To associate others is basically Islamic for elevating anyone besides God to divine status. But to be quite fair, I look at this passage and I agree with that. I don't agree with Allah, but I agree that there are no other gods. There's only one God, and He is only worthy of our worship. The Bible explains God to be far more complex than a single entity. And let me illustrate it with this. You think back to the time of Moses. You have God in Moses, moving him to speak words by divine inspiration. You've got God at the same time in the form of either a cloud or a fire. You have God at the same time enthroned in heaven, and at the same time you have God binding the whole universe together. Now, how can one God, one single entity, do all of that at the same time? You see, the Bible's concept of God is far more complex. Far more complex than what the Quran presents. Continuing on to the next slide. This comes from Surah 5, 72 and 73. They have disbelieved who say Allah is the Messiah, the Son of Mary. The Messiah himself said, "O children of Israel, worship Allah my Lord and your Lord. Whoever ascribes partners to Allah, for him Allah has forbidden paradise. His abode is the fire. For the unjust there will be no helpers. Once again, here we have a statement attributed to Jesus 500 years after he said it. We have no historical background to this whatsoever. It's not found anywhere in the Gospels. And yet, the Quran claims that Jesus says this. And he's warning the people, don't ascribe partners to Allah. Don't associate anyone with him. For to do so carries with it a severe penalty. Verse 73, they have disbelieved who say Allah is the third of three, when there is no God save one God. If they cease not what they say, a painful torment will fall upon them, those of them who have disbelieved. Now, did you catch that second verse? That Allah is the third of three. That's basically Quranic code for the Trinity, or what I like to call the triunity. The third of three. Now there's a couple other things I'd like to draw out. Notice that the sin is calling Allah the Messiah. You see, Jesus is called the Messiah throughout the Quran. But the mistake, the sin, is saying that Allah is the Messiah. Or in other words, making Jesus divine, making him deity, making him equal with God. Notice also that he is the son of Mary. And I want you to key in on that. File that in the back of your mind for just a moment, because that's going to become very important in just a couple of minutes. Jesus, in these verses, is depicted as calling God's people back to true worship. And paradise will be withheld from those who ascribe partners to God. And those who do so are going to perish in hell. They are guilty of shirk. Now, this is where, in my mind, the Quranic view of the Jew and the Christian becomes extremely convoluted. Because on one hand, the Quran is accusing the Christian of a severe sin, one that runs the risk of hell and destruction. But on the other hand, it's saying, don't bother the people of the book. They're good people. Let them worship in peace. Which is it? It's like the Quran wants to have it both ways. But I digress. Over in Surah 21, 24 through 26, the Quran asks, or have they taken other gods besides him? Say, bring your proofs. This is the reminder of those who are with me, and this is the reminder of those before me. But most of them do not know the truth, and they turn away. We sent no messenger before you, but that we revealed to him that there is no God but I, so worship me. Notice verse 25. And this goes back to something we were talking about last night. Remember, the Muslim narrative goes something like this. Prophets like Moses and Jesus came teaching the will of Allah. But it was man that perverted it. Man that changed it. Man that ascribed to Jesus glory and honor that was not due him. Verse 26. They say, the All-Merciful has taken a son. Transcendent is Allah. No, but only honored servants. This is a denial that Jesus is the Son of God in the biblical sense of that term. And you can argue with people about what Son of God means, and sometimes it means something in a metaphorical sense, and sometimes it means something in a very literal sense. Well, when it comes to Jesus, it's talking about it in a very literal sense. I didn't hit anything, so at least I don't think I did. So we'll continue on. Son of God, when it comes to Jesus, means he has divine DNA. He is both God and man. But the Quran says, do not say such things. Over in Surah 4, 171 and 72. Boy, you can't read this one, can you? I guess you'll just have to listen closely here. This is what is said. O people of the book, and this is talking to you and me, and I want you to listen very carefully to what's said to us. Commit no excess in your religion, nor say anything about the truth of Allah. Let's just stop there. To ascribe to Jesus divinity, to call him deity in the from the Quranic perspective, is to commit excess in religion. In other words, is to take things a step too far. No. There's one God but Allah, and if you say that Jesus is the Son of God, that he's divine in origin, that he is an uncreated being, that's excess. That's taking it one step too far. The Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, was only a messenger of Allah, and his words which he conveyed to Mary and a spirit from him. So believe in Allah and his messengers, and say not three. Cease. It is better for you. Allah is only one God, for it is removed from him, from his transcendence, that he should have a son, when he is all that the heavens and all that the earth contain. And Allah is sufficient as their custodian. Now catch this part and think about what we talked about last night. The Messiah will never be too proud to be slave to Allah. Nor will the nearest angels, those who are too proud to worship him and are arrogant, all such will he assemble to him. Basically, this very lengthy couple of verses is saying the Christian has taken it one step too far. Jesus is just a messenger of God. That he and Mary are just human beings. And to take it that next step is to be guilty of shirk. Because Allah cannot beget, nor has he begotten. And unlike the Messiah, who was humble and who wasn't too proud, you Christians are too proud to recognize this. And what's the problem with the world according to the Muslim? Pride, right? In other words, those who believe in Jesus Christ are stiff-necked, hard-hearted. We're resisting the will of Allah. We're not willing to surrender and submit. The Messiah, Jesus, he was not like that. He wasn't too arrogant or too proud, but we are. And that is essentially the problem with Christians. We just think of ourselves more highly than we ought to think. We're too proud to embrace Islam. Now, I've touched on this several different times, but have you noticed in a lot of these quotations, you have Jesus called the Son of Mary. Have you caught that? Son of Mary. A 12th century Muslim commentator by the name of Abul al-Qasim Mahmud ibn Umar az-Zamakhshari. Yeah, that. That's a mouthful right there, and I don't want to butcher it anymore and insult the Arabic language. He wrote a commentary on the Quran, and he offers this description of what the Quran has to say about the Trinity. According to the evidence of the Quran, the Christians maintain that God, Christ, and Mary are three gods, and that Christ is the child of God by Mary. As God says in the Quran, O Jesus, son of Mary, didst thou say unto man, take me and my mother as gods apart from God. That's from Surah 5, 116. Or the Christians say, the Messiah is the Son of God. Moreover, it is well known that the Christians maintain that in Jesus are combined the divine nature derived from the Father and a human nature derived from his mother. At the same time, these words exclude the Christian view that Jesus had with God the usual relationship between sons and their fathers. Now, did you catch the first half of that quote? Who comprises the Trinity from the view of the Quran? Is it the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit? No. It's God, Jesus, and Mary. Now think about that for a second. Where did Muhammad get that idea? Where did that come from? Did that come from a reading of the New Testament? I tell you, Mary's just barely mentioned in the New Testament in comparison to most of the major characters. I mean, she played a pretty significant role, wouldn't you say? But in comparison to the rest of the major characters in the New Testament, she's virtually not seen. How could one conclude by carefully reading the New Testament that Mary is divine? Well, no one could. That's just an extrapolation, right? And that's something that happened later on down the road when these philosophers and theologians were trying to explain how Jesus could be born without the taint of Adam's sin. Well, it must have been because his mother was immaculately conceived. And that's why, in some denominations, there are statues of Mary. Mary is prayed to. Mary has incense burned to her. Mary is worshipped and venerated. Now, if you are an Arab living in 7th century Saudi Arabia, what sort of Christianity are you likely to be exposed to at that time? Well, probably what we would call the Syrian Orthodox was likely the dominant approach to God at that time as far as Christianity, so-called, was concerned. So in other words, the Quran is getting its view of the doctrine of the Trinity not from the Bible, but from where? From an apostate form of Christianity. From a form of Christianity that's completely foreign to the New Testament. And yet, as this commentator says, and as we've seen implied in all those quotations, the Quran says that Christians believe that Mary is God. This man quotes from Surah 5, 116. O Jesus, Son of Mary, didst thou say unto men, take me and my mother as gods apart from God? Basically what Allah is saying, Jesus never asked for man to ascribe to either he or his mother divine qualities. Well, Scripture never ascribes to Mary divine qualities. And this is why I think we need to step back and consider very carefully, is the Quran another revelation from God? If it can botch up this big of a doctrine, if it can offer such a poor description of what the Trinity entails, how can it possibly be divinely inspired? We know what was in the New Testament at the time that Muhammad was living and preaching. We know it because we have copies of it that go back clear to the 4th century, and then we've got papyri fragments that take us clear back into the 2nd century, as I mentioned this morning. We know what was in the New Testament at the time that Muhammad was preaching. And yet, he offers a description of a central Christian doctrine that is erroneous. It's false. How can this man possibly be a prophet sent from God? There's another warning in the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy, I think it's in chapter 13. Moses talks to the people about how to tell a false prophet from a true prophet. He says, if a man arises and he's able to predict something that will happen in the future and that thing comes to pass, but at the same time he says, let's go worship other gods, don't follow him. You see, there are people who are pretty savvy, who can predict the future, but if you listen closely to what they teach, and you compare that to what the Lord has revealed, you can separate the false from the true. My friends, Muhammad claims to have presented to mankind a book that has eternally existed. And yet in that book, it cannot properly explain the Christian doctrine of the Trinity that is so clearly illustrated in the New Testament. Why? Why should we believe that Muhammad is a prophet sent from God? There's no reason to do so. As I close this morning, I want to encourage you to think about the true identity of Jesus Christ. That He is the Son of God. That He sits at the right hand of God, glorified, sovereign over all created things. And this morning, if you're not a follower of His, but you recognize that you have sin that needs to be forgiven, and you know that that sin is keeping you from being with God for eternity, we invite you to confess this morning that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, to commit your life to following after Him, not after any other man, because in Him is the way, the truth, and the life. If we can help you obey the gospel this morning, please come forward as we stand and sing.